You're listening to the Property Nomads podcast, your one-stop shop for property, business and travel-related content, tying it all together to help guide you towards success. If you like the podcast, please share with others, subscribe and leave us a review. So get your gear together and let's get going.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Rich Little and I'm here with Rob Smallbone of the Property Nomads podcast. And he's very kindly asked me to come in today to have a little chat. So who am I? I'm Rich Little. I've been investing in property since kind of 2003 in the property circle, from your buy-to-lets, from your HMOs, all through the standard investment avenue, all running alongside a military career. I spent 11 years in the Navy before transferring across to the Air Force. I'm a pilot by trade, flying helicopters and now fixed wing and jets. Throughout that time, deployed multiple times from Iraq in 2003, which was the invasion of Iraq, so I was part of the war invasion, through Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, basically every military conflict the UK has been involved in since I joined in 1998, I have been involved in. So that has been quite exciting, all the while running a property business on the side. The property now has gone into development. We're doing multiple developments with GDVs of up to about £5 million, but we're also utilizing many different creative avenues in order to do those developments, from council grants, from government grants, to the use of foreign investors' money. So we're very creatively doing that. Last part of myself is I also run a business called Battlefields to Business, which is, again, harping back to my military services, really to utilize and train people leaving the service into business and into property investment, and allows them to use funding available to them as military people to facilitate that training. With that comes a small charitable arm, which is Homes Fit for Heroes, which aims to house homeless ex-servicemen. So I think that's the introduction. Rob asked me to do an introduction. Hopefully I haven't harped on for too long, but that's me, Richard Little.
Oh, Rich, thank you very much, and thank you for your time today. It's really, really appreciated, and say very good to point out with your experience in the RAF and so forth. Of course, it is Armistice Day, so on behalf of certainly myself and everyone at the Property Nomads podcast, and we always think it's important to pay homage to those that have made the ultimate sacrifice. I'm sure that's something that you would resonate with as well.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, obviously, it is a very important day in my calendar as a serviceman, but obviously family. I've got a lot of family who were from the wars all the way through to now. You know, we don't just remember those who lost their lives in the world wars, but obviously all the way up to now in modern day conflicts. So all servicemen on Armistice Day, it is very important to remember the past.
Totally agree on that. And rolling back to the very start, I suppose, before we go on to the property stuff and we get into those sort of bits and bobs, yeah. Why the RAF in the first place, the Royal Air Force?
Well, I originally joined the Navy. So I joined the Navy in kind of 1998, so a good little while ago. I originally joined the Navy as a pilot. And why did I join the Navy? I had a family history in the Navy. And you know, a lot of people would still say, chop my arm off, I am dark blue. I am dark blue as the services go. I am naval at heart. I had a family history in the Navy, joined as a helicopter pilot. But really, my passion was I wanted to be a Harrier pilot. So a certain type of jet, the Navy flew it. I wanted to fly them. As I went through training, I wasn't quite good enough to get the scores needed to fly the Harrier, so I ended up flying what are called commando helicopters. I flew commando helicopters for a number of years and search and rescue. And really, I was given an opportunity in kind of 2007 to transfer into flying jets, which I wanted to do. That's why I joined the Navy, was specifically to fly this jet. I was given an opportunity in 2007 to retrain from helicopter flying into flying the Harrier. I grabbed that with both hands, and you know, I went down that route for a few years flying or training to fly jets for the Navy. Ultimately, we got to the end of that training. The Navy cut the Harrier. And at that point, I thought, well, instead of going back to flying helicopters, I wanted to continue flying jets. How could I do that? Well, I transferred service. And it was one of those things, all of a sudden, one day I was in the Navy, the next day I was in the Royal Air Force. And really then I carried on a career from that day in the Royal Air Force, flying jets for them until this day now. And really for the past few years, I've been in the training role, training the new pilots of the forces to fly. But it was really a family history. joining the forces. It's something I would recommend to everybody. Go and do it for 5 years. I'd recommend it to my kids, everybody else's children. Go and do it for 5 years. You see the world, you make friends that you'd never, ever make anywhere else. And it's an experience.
Yeah. So many questions from that. There's so many questions. To completely go complete off topic,
yeah.
Do you think military service should be mandatory in the UK?
Oh, difficult one. I think the level of discipline that is kind of needed in the generation that is growing up now could well be good for certain areas of society. I think it would sort out a lot of problems. You look at the countries that do still have kind of conscription or something, or mandatory service that it does, you know, like for instance Switzerland does, and you look at their kind of youth offending rates, they are far, far lower than the UK. But on the flip side, I like the fact that we've got armed forces where everybody wants to be there. At least they want to be there at the beginning. They may not after 3 or 4 years. You know, we've got a lot of, the forces do hemorrhage a lot of people for various reasons. And a lot of people leave the forces after 3, 4, 5 years. But at the start, everyone wants to be there. It creates that camaraderie. I think that would be diminished, shall we say, if people were forced into those training environments. Yeah. So do I can see its benefit, but I don't actually. I quite like the fact we are a voluntary force. However, we're struggling to man the armed forces at the minute, so where do we go with that?
Yeah. Probably a question you're in a better position to answer than myself.
Well, yeah, who knows, to be honest. I mean, I'm coming to the end of it. Yeah, I'm coming to the end of my time, 21 years. I'll leave this year, October this year. So that's me leaving the forces. I've loved every minute of it. I'd happily start again. Classically, I'd say it's not the force that I joined, you know, so it has changed over 20 years, but I would do it all again. I would absolutely do it all again.
No regrets whatsoever. You would go hell for leather
100%. 100%. Nothing. I've changed nothing. Do you know, me starting a property business had nothing to do with a lot of the kind of, certainly the things that you hear now with property businesses, people are starting and getting into property so that they can leave their full-time jobs and be able to create that passive income, that financial freedom in order to leave their job. That was never, ever a kind of a consideration in my mind. I built that up for choice. I saw what it was doing. You know, I saw the power of property. I saw where property investing was, but it was never to build an income on the side in order to leave my day job. I would do my day job for, I was going to say for half of the money, but I wouldn't. But you know, you get the analogy.
Definitely get the analogy. I mean, before we go and deep dive into the property stuff, I'm sure people are listening thinking, you know, get on with it, get on with talking about property. I mean, in terms of, you know, you've been deployed to Iraq, you've been deployed to Afghanistan and Libya. I mean, just for those of us that have never been in the services or anything like that, I mean, just how does that feel to be in a war zone?
Do you know what? It's an interesting one because you're ultimately just doing your job. Do you know, and I remember, you know, certainly we'll go back to 2003, which was the invasion of Iraq. So it was, you know, the UK, we had declared war on another country. That was, well, you look at Afghanistan, that's a conflict, subtly different, but it was, we had not declared war on a country since the Falklands in 1982. And I remember, you know, all of a sudden we're sailing around on a ship, HMS Ocean, and the idea was we were going to go from the ship, from HMS Ocean, onto what was called the Al-Faw Peninsula, then up to Basra in Iraq. So we were invading a country. I remember sat on board the ship and just thinking, wow, this is fantastic. This is what we have trained for. You know, you go through, you know, that was 2003. I'd been in training since 1998. And all of the scenarios, the exercises, everything you do in training are scenarios surrounding what you're going to do if this should happen. And lo and behold, it happened. So all of it, you just find yourself, we're doing what we were trained to do. Yes, there's fear, there's moments of, you know, holy crap, we're not loading our weapons with blank ammunition, we're loading it with live ammunition. There are those sort of things. You know, and on that first night of the invasion, there was, you know, two helicopters collided, killed 15 people. You know, there was a lot of things that went on which were devastating. That's the point it kind of became reality. So it actually almost took that event for it to become real. But certainly launching from that ship and going into invasion, you were so pumped and so hyped, thinking, I am doing what I've been trained and I'm at the top of my game. You wanted to be there. Yeah.
I can only imagine just the amount of adrenaline that must have been running through not just yourself, but obviously all your comrades as well. It must have been incredible.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, we are trained to do that. You know, you think what you will of war and conflict, whatever, but I had joined an armed forces. That's what I didn't join with the impression I wouldn't potentially be doing this. But and then lo and behold, when the day came, the training came through. We did what we were trained to do, and that's, you know, lo and behold, that's what we did. And everyone was focused in the right mindset. And, you know, that comes back to mindset. Mindset's a big one at the moment. You know, we talk about mindset in business, talk about mindset in property. And a lot of people lately are talking about mindset. And everybody has the right to talk about mindset. It's very good to talk in general. But, you know, to be able to, you know, there's different elements of mindset, shall we say. So my mindset at that time was single-minded focus on the job in hand, but never lost sight of, you know, the peripheries around us. But it's very much a mindset thing. You could crumble, you know, in a heartbeat. And I think to come on the back end of that, which comes back to kind of the charitable arm, which, you know, I'm starting in a minute, which is Homes Fit for Heroes. The reason why it's kind of almost coming back to us now, these guys have had mindset to the nth degree for so long, focus, that's what we're going to do. Then all of a sudden they take themselves from that environment into another environment, i.e. they've left the armed forces, they find their mind can't focus anywhere. You know, people work at different paces in office buildings or where they go. And I say the PTSD issues are huge one. You know, they're carrying a lot of, you know, untold baggage. So actually mindset, again, kind of crumbles, shall we say, you know, the focus and things like that. So I think mindset within the armed forces is very key. It's being able to harness it in the right avenue. I think I've just rambled on a wee bit there about mindset, but mindset is very, it's something that's very close to my heart. And actually you can, with the right mindset, you can achieve a lot, but you can also destroy a lot very quickly if you've got the wrong mindset.
Our limits only exist in the mind.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, that is something very true. And I've always said from a, you know, you can genuinely do anything. You know, and I put a recent, like post up on Facebook about mindset, and the crux of it was really is a saying that was once said to me was be there at the end. And when you say the limits, and it's be there at the end, have that goal in mind, right? I will be there at the end, and then obviously all the micro goals in between. And that was born out of, actually it was a run at the time, and I was, you know, suffering halfway through the run, and somebody just said to me, you better be there at the end. And it was the authoritative manner that was said to me. That was, he hit the key, shall we say. So that the way he said that to me was the key to unlock me. Had somebody else just said, come on Richard, you're not too tired, you can run, that wasn't the key, I would have probably given up. So mindset is about finding that key to unlock that kind of untapped resource. He hit the key by saying be there at the end. I then perked up and I was there at the end. So, and that's where kind of coaching of individuals comes in, coaching, understanding individuals, understanding who you're working with, building rapport. It's not something that you can write down and learn. It just comes from experience more than anything else.
Along with many things in life, experience is crucial. You're going to go and you're going to find things that you're good at, find things that you're not good at. You're going to have good experiences, you're going to have bad experiences. As long as you can learn from them and adapt.
Yeah,
you'll be absolutely fine.
Totally, and I think that's it. It's learning, adapting. I think a lot of people, you know, I think take your blinkers off. A lot of people are a little bit too, you know, have focus, but be aware of everything around you. And I think there's a lot of people in certain avenues of life are very single-minded, focus, drive, determination, etc. And I do 100% believe in that you need that. But I also believe in awareness. Take your blinkers off. Look, take in everything's around you. Don't get distracted by the shiny penny, shall we say. Especially that's important in the property world. You know, don't get distracted by that shiny penny, but be aware it exists.
One more question on mentality before we, you know, start getting into the property. So PTSD, just touched upon it there, Ed. I will ask questions, that's what I do. Is that something you've ever suffered with as a result of being in the...
I wouldn't have said I'd suffered with it per se, but then probably I have in the fact that I'm even, you know, sat not answering that question directly. Yes, you will always have thoughts. You know, there's times that there's certain times, you know, I say what this is on Armistice Day and things like that you do naturally go back and remember. There's times throughout the year though, which I would naturally remember certain days when, colleagues of mine have been killed and things like that. And it is a reality. You know, when I said there I would promote the armed forces to anybody, I still would. But if I look back at my class, my flight, when I went through training, 50% of that flight are no longer with us. Now, that is one hell of a statistic to say 50%. And that's not all related to military, but a lot of it is, you know. So, you know, a helicopter crash killed four people. There was another one crashed and she drowned in a helicopter that sank. There was, you know, so it's, you know, then I think of all the times that I was deployed and the things that I saw. So you naturally carry a lot of, should we say, baggage of things that you've seen. I think I've personally, my mentality's handled that quite well. But what that's allowed me to do is it's enabled me to see in others the baggage that they're carrying and possibly that they aren't able to release it. And that's kind of where PTSD. So I wouldn't necessarily say I'd suffered from it, but I think it's made me acutely aware of spotting it in others. But some go very unnoticed. Some hide it so, so well. But, you know, I've got a couple of good friends who I would categorically say have got PTSD. They would never answer, never once would they admit it to themselves. But I know it, and there's certain times throughout the year I know possibly I'll call them at a certain time or I'll go and meet them for a drink on a certain day because I know they are the days they would be suffering. And I think certainly with people in the armed forces, they need the friends, the family around them, certainly the ones who've been in combat for the past, you know, I was in combat for 20 years. We're in a period now with the armed forces that we're not at combat, shall we say. But I joined at a time that, you know, we've been at combat for 20 years. Yeah, it's a long time. You know, and I bounced from one, you know, from one conflict to another. It's cost me a marriage. It's cost me the, you know, my young daughter. You know, it's cost a lot throughout the way. And actually, I relate a lot of that to the kind of the endless deployments away from home. Yeah.
That's absolutely incredible to get a much sort of clearer insight into. You know, an example of someone that's been seven for such a long time, and, you know, very, very interesting, I think, to say the least. Moving along into property, and you said that when you started building a portfolio on the side, as well as being the armed forces, that there wasn't a financial motivation or a time motivation. So what gave you the idea in the first place to start investing into bricks and mortar?
Classic accidental landlord. Yeah, not even accidental, I would say, but that is in essence how it started. So I, you know, back then, 2003, deployed away, I owned my own house. I knew when they said, right, you're off to join this ship, we're going to war in Iraq. I was like, God knows when we'll be back. So I thought, well, I might as well rent the house out. So that was it. I had a little two-bed cottage, still own the cottage to this day. And I thought, I'll just rent it out. So that rented out, paid the mortgage. When I came back eventually from Iraq, I was then posted away from Somerset. That's where I was at the time. I was posted away from Somerset and I went from there up to Scotland. So I just left that tenant in situ. Moved up to Scotland. When I was in Scotland, they provide you with accommodation, but at the time I was, had a new partner up there, bought a little flat while I was up there. 2 years later, was moved away from Scotland. Actually, instead of selling that flat, I rented it out. So it was that. Initially, that kind of accidental into landlord, always properties that I lived in. When I was in Scotland, I started to do a lot more education into the different types of strategies out there. And that was really when I first came across kind of HMOs, co-living, whatever, you know, it was effectively HMOs. But, you know, we're rolling back to the late 2000s. They were not, anybody who's investing in HMOs now, if you went back into one of my HMOs back then, you would think, how the hell did he even get away with this? But that was the game, you know, back then you didn't need the fire regulations that you need now because not everybody and their dog was doing it. But yeah, that's how I ended up getting into it. So it wasn't, when you say it wasn't financially motivated, I didn't start with the financial motivation, but obviously I then saw the power of real estate, shall we say, the power of buy-to-let investments, which opened my eyes, that awareness, as I say. You know, I was focused on my career, but all of a sudden I was thinking, you know, I've got this investment. How can I now make that, you know, how can I do better at that investment? Lo and behold, instead of a buy-to-let flat, I then looked at an HMO, and that was kind of my natural stepping stone. And at that start, there wasn't a huge amount of property education per se that you may see now. So a lot of it was done, you know, there wasn't YouTubes to watch videos, there wasn't as many books. But there was a lot of kind of American real estate books at the time. There was a few UK ones, few, you know, stuff about HMO investing and, you know, about what to do. But kind of, I was teaching myself a lot of it, quite frankly, which goes against really, you know, so those few years did take me longer to get into it, but I was doing it on the side alongside my job and I just enjoyed it more than anything else.
And evidently you've kept it going because, say, you've got Battlefields the Business and also Homes Fit for Heroes. Can you dive into a bit about Homes Fit for Heroes and the process behind that, how it is at the moment and what plans you've got for that moving forward?
Yeah, so with that, you know, with that, it's kind of, it's one of those things that's been with myself and another military colleague of mine who is big into property as well. We sat around and that's who Battlefields the Business with as well, so the same pair. And really it's about that, the PTSD element. There's a huge post-Afghanistan era, so British force pulled out of Afghanistan. Again, you've got to look back previous 10 years. There was a lot of like army units. You know, I was flying helicopter units. We were back-to-back Afghanistan, so we'd spent a lot of time away. So the post-traumatic stress in those individuals was quite high. On the back of that, it forced a lot of servicemen to have relationship, family issues. So all of a sudden, a lot of divorces, a lot of separations. So actually, if you looked at the statistics of the homelessness rate of ex-servicemen, it was exponentially rising. Homelessness was going up as a UK anyway, but actually the proportion of ex-servicemen within that homelessness was rising as well, because they were coming back, they had serious mental health issues with PTSD, they had serious housing issues because, lo and behold, they'd just been possibly in a married quarter, which was provided for them by the military, but they had a family, lo and behold, breakdown of family. They were finding themselves struggling. The armed forces is very much kind of a drinking and a social culture, and it was creating a lot of you know, alcohol issues and things like that. So I saw this and I thought, there's no support network for these kind of people, and I just started engaging with kind of homelessness charities and saying, right, can we set up certain properties? You know, can we invest in properties in the area, but make, say, this HMO specifically for 5X servicemen? And that's kind of what we were doing. So we were using the investment arm of it as well. So I was investing in a property to make it into, let's say, a 5-bedroom HMO. And then these individuals who were homeless, we were taking the homeless off the streets, but specifically ex-servicemen. And what that meant is, when I felt I was helping the ex-servicemen, but it also meant I could engage. I was engaging with people on the same level. I could speak their language. So actually, when a lot of people think, I don't want to use my HMOs for kind of homelessness or anything like that, which I'm doing a lot more of these days, not necessarily in the military sector, but in the social housing sector. A lot of people wouldn't necessarily want to do that, but I could engage with these kind of ex-military individuals on a level that they understood. And they respect places. You know, they're brought up, they've lived a career in the military of respect the surroundings that you're in. So yes, they've been homeless, but they've been homeless through, I'm going to say, the environment that they came from, yeah, but they still had a lot of self-respect, a lot of self-discipline, and actually I was giving them the opportunity to come off the street, live in a property, and it was rapid how quickly they got back on their feet. So that's kind of the vision of it. It's helping an area of society that I've got an acute awareness of, i.e. the service person. I've never been homeless, so not both elements of it, should we say, but the acute awareness of the and really seeing something that I could help. It's very close to me, you know, ex-servicemen, and actually they're down in their luck, really.
Do you think you would have, got a bit of a hypothetical question, but do you think you would have gone down that route if you hadn't been an ex-serviceman yourself?
I'd potentially have gone down, so in the property investing field, I'd have potentially gone down the social housing route, which is something else. Would I have niched it into ex-servicemen? Well, probably not, actually. Probably not, because I wouldn't necessarily have understood their acute issues, shall we say. You know, I can understand how quickly somebody who's possibly a very powerful person in their military field can very, very quickly almost end up with nothing. I can really see that transition in a lot of kind of, would I have seen that if I wasn't in the military? Probably not. And what I mean by that is, you can live 20 years in the military and you can live from provided accommodation, i.e. in block accommodation, we would call it, where you join the military, you can move from that into married quarter accommodation, which, you know, we'll not get into the standard of married quarter accommodation, is pretty poor these days, but that's a completely different argument. But you, in essence, could move from these levels of accommodation throughout your career. The payments for that come off your salary at source, so pre-tax, so lo and behold, it costs you a lot less. And then what happens is people will leave the forces after 20 odd years, having never owned a house themselves. You know, and that happens. It encourages them to live in a kind of a paycheck culture, coupled with PTSD, coupled with failed relationships. Actually, I can see how very, very quickly somebody who may be a very powerful person in a military setting, once they're in uniform, can very quickly, out of uniform, be a broken person. So I can see that bridge, which the question was, would I be in this if I was this sector, if I wasn't in the military? Probably not, because I wouldn't have seen that bridge. I would have probably just seen that person as a homeless individual who had served in the armed forces. I wouldn't have seen how quickly, you know, that situation could happen to them.
And having that accumulated all as one, you then use that as inspiration to do exactly what you're doing now, is that correct?
Yeah, in essence. Absolutely, yeah. I was seeing a sector that needed help. So I thought, right, I'll try and help that. And then I'd say it's stepped up and gone more into, I'd say, the social housing sector is one that I do now. So, but the charitable arm is very much niching for the ex-servicemen who are down in their luck. But actually, I also see social housing as a huge area that needs help.
For people that might be listening in on this, thinking, well, they might just stick to their, you know, regular HMOs or regular buy-to-lets and so forth. People might be thinking, well, you know, Rich, that sounds great, but how does the funding work on that? Have you got any insights into how you get around or work with lenders and funders on these?
Yeah, so I mean, right. So we'll cover, you know, so it used to be LHA rates. So, you know, a lot of, if you've got some, you know, and a lot of people will look at LHA rates. So I'll try and give you a quick rundown of it. But in essence, the social sector is, it's not just, you know, people on benefits or anything like that. But in essence, you may be getting your funding from there. So I use the LHA rates really when I'm looking at a goldmine area. So even back to basics of property investing. If I want to work somewhere new, I will always know what the LHA rates are in the area. Why? Because ultimately, I want to know if I can't put my private tenant in there, or the rental demand in the private sector isn't what I think it is or what I thought it was when I was doing my research, I know what I'll get as a base rate, because that LHA rate, I could give the property to the council and they will give me that money. So that's something I use in my goldmine area research. So for instance, I know in Hull it's £433 per month. Your rental rate may be £450 for your one bed flat when you're doing your research. So I know actually, ultimately, if I can't get a private tenant, I can quickly overnight get £433 off the council. So I know the LHA rate. I use that as my basic research for a goldmine area. How then it works? What I do is I basically would engage with council organisations, charities, things like that. There's a lot of grants currently available. So for instance, literally this morning I came from a property of mine, which is a one bed flat that needs a complete refurbishment. Not as a result of the tenant who was in there, so it's not a bad tenant or anything like that, it just needed a refurbishment. That's being fully funded, well, a grant of £15,000 in order to do that. So lo and behold, because I'm then going to rent that back to the social centre, I can tap into a grant of £15,000 to do that. So all of a sudden I've got a nicely refurbished flat, hasn't cost me a penny. No, some, don't get me wrong, every council is subtly different, and some people have said to me, but Richard, not my council, you've got to pay £1,000 up front, you've got to the council. You've got to subtly look into the intricacies of your area. But I then use that funding, rent that back to the council. There's a lot of these pots of funding. There's a funding stream I spoke about earlier on with yourself off record, but it's called the Moving On Fund. You know, that is a fund that potentially can 100% fund developments. In order to then rent back to the social centre. They're grants, not loans, so you're never expected to pay it back. That's a key thing for me. So it's about providing a service and working with the granting and the funding available. It is a whole different field in itself, but actually I use that grant arm, shall we say, to facilitate my buy-to-let, my HMOs, my developments. Where am I going to get the funding from? When you talk about lenders, yes, there are fewer lenders who will lend on it, but there's still enough.
Even in a limited company structure, there are still people you can go out there and...
Still, they will still lend at 75%, you know, loan to value. You may pay a quarter to a 0.5% more because it's classed as subtly higher risk. Mm-hmm. But vice that, I can have a 10-bed HMO that I can give out on a 5-year lease. you know, 5-year lease, that's full bills included. That's, I just sit back and I take in the money, generally getting around 85% of market rates. But let's look at an HMO. If I was getting 100%, I'd be given probably 12 to 15% to an agent anyway. Then I've got my bills. So actually, the benefits of the social, if you know how to work it well and work within the boundaries and the guidelines of the grants and the funds available, it's a phenomenal sector. People have been too quick to shy away from it, because everybody has been tarred with that same brush, where actually the social sector encompasses, you know, for instance, single mothers who possibly have had to leave an abusive place, who may move into a place and make it the most beautiful family home possible. It encompasses, you know, all sorts of people, but unfortunately people have tarred the social sector all with one brush, and it's not quite like that.
Well, people should look into it.
People should look into it. Well, yeah, it's huge. It is huge. I mean, as I say, people have been too quick to jump on the high-end HMO market, the high-end buy-to-let, the SA model. All fantastic strategies, fantastic models. However, I do look at the high-end HMO model at the moment across the country. It's almost getting, people are trying to outdo one another. You know, I saw a student HMO not long ago, and they had 32-inch plasma, like, flat-screen TVs in the wall room. I was like, And I was like, I would live here. So it's the kind of getting to the, you know, I always wanted to move out of the house that I live in. And I was like, this room is better than my house. Is it a race for the bottom? You know, that's what is it? You know, people are getting, but then you've just got to look at the rates they're getting. They were still only getting, you know, £120 per week per room for that, where my LHA room, I'll be getting 100 on a lease for 5 years. No damages, no, you know, the possibilities are endless. I'm not saying it's for everybody, don't get me wrong, but I think people are too eager to jump on the high-end luxury model. High-end luxury model does phenomenally well, but let's not forget the other end of the spectrum as well.
That all depends where you're coming from, you know, a landlord, landlady's perspective, because, yeah, you know, certainly what, you know, my buying business partner, Aaron, and I, you know, we tried experimenting with social housing to start off with, found that, you know, a lot of lenders, especially in limited company format a few years ago, were very closed. Now, okay, it's easy to sit back and blame the lenders for it, but at the same time, I ask myself the same question, could I have looked harder? Could I have done this? Could I have done that? Point being that, you know, I believe we have a social responsibility as well. So it is very poignant and interesting to get your perspective about what you're doing, how you're doing it. I think that's, you know,
yeah, I think you're very right, and I think that's what scared a lot of people away. You know, let's go back, you know, let's roll back a few years with social housing, where it was potentially a lot harder to get loans on it in a limited company structure. It possibly was, so it scared people away. People may have got their first property and had a bad tenant, and then all of a sudden they think, right, I am tarring the entire social sector with that brush. That's understandable, but you could also get a bad tenant, you know, in the professional sector, you may have just had one. And again, don't get me wrong, I don't really mind bad tenants, and I'll tell you why. I've done a number of evictions over my time, but and not just in socials, but in normal, you know, the private sector as well. What's the benefit? Well, let's say my private sector tenant decides he's not going to pay his rent. Well, he's not going to pay his rent. I can do nothing about that for a set number of months before I serve him a notice, before I take him to court, etc. So lo and behold, there we are, so many months down the line before I appear in court to get a possession notice of the apartment. If I serve a notice on my social tenant, at least the rent's getting paid, because it's coming directly from the government. So if I'm evicting him for, let's call it, antisocial behaviour, whatever it may be, at least the rent's getting paid.
You don't think that would be two things on that? Number one, if the government do set away with Section 21, that's going to make life a bit more difficult.
You can always Section 8.
True. I'm not happy to Section 8, but I know that a lot of people say that process can be such a pain in the nuts. Is that, or have you found it different?
It's a classic case of, you know, when I say about be aware earlier on, you know, be aware of it. Be acutely aware of when you can serve a Section 8. So again, and when you can't, when it's got to be a 21 Section 8. And then if you're going to do it, be acutely aware of how you do it correctly. You know, when you say it's a pain in the tits about it, because if you get it wrong, you're back to square one and you're doing the whole thing again. So, you know, again, just, it's education, isn't it? It's that classic education. The first time you probably will learn about Section 8 is the day you've got to do one. You know, nobody goes out and learns about it thinking, oh, I'll put that in my back pocket just in case I have to use that in 2 months' time. So the first time you do, so just take a bit of time to understand and understand what could subsequently trip you up. There's enough experience out there of people who've had to serve them. And it's, for me, it's, I always look at where can this go wrong? Right, okay, it could go wrong there. So let me mitigate against that now before I submit the paperwork. But as I say, the key for me is at least your rent's getting paid throughout this whole process.
My second question on that would be, do you think, again, at the time of recording, you know, Universal Credit's a bit here, a bit there. Does Universal Credit affect that in any way, shape or form?
Yeah, now Universal Credit, in essence, what has caused this huge problem. And Universal Credit isn't, I mean, I could sit and harp on about Universal Credit all day because...
Bring you back for a second episode.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is in essence what has caused a massive increase in the number of homeless people now. And those who aren't familiar with Universal Credit, what it was the LHA, Local Housing Authority rate, was paid by the Local Housing Authority. So if I owned a, you know, we're sat in Hull now, so let's say I had my LHA property in Hull, the money would come from Hull City Council. I would know in Hull City Council who I needed to speak to if I needed to speak to them. It was a very easy communication line. When the government brought in Universal Credit, and I can see the big picture of behind Universal Credit, why they did it in order to promote people getting back into work, but it's failing at an acutely small level. So it's failing at that level where local councils are having to pick up the tab. The issue with Universal Credit, instead of calling your local housing council, and I'll call one desk in there who I know I'm calling, I'm now dealing with a government organisation of an 0800 number that you will never get through to anybody who speaks to you. And all that happened was to roll out Universal Credit, landlords left the social sector in droves because it made it more difficult. It is getting better. There are ways to work within Universal Credit, have the rents paid directly to you, access to certain portals which allow you to see your tenants' payments, etc. It is getting better. It's by no means perfect. The greatest win in the social sector, and that's why councils are now leasing properties. The win in the social sector now is that lease. So councils have seen that landlords are leaving in droves. So what they're saying is, right, I'll tell you what, instead of you dealing with Universal Credit, the turnover of tenants, somebody not possibly having issues, we will lease that property from you. We will look after that and we'll just pay you whatever the lease agreement fee is. That's becoming more and more popular. And again, it's out there. You've just got to you've got to work within it, speak to the right people, speak to the right departments, know where to go with it.
And it's like with most things in property, isn't it? It's focus. So if you know that you want to go down that route, put all your eggs in one basket, but certainly have the bulk of your time looking at that, looking at all these, you know, implications, benefits, etc., etc. And once you made that decision, go for it, find the right people and just crack on.
And I mean, I've almost taken it to the next level now with development. So I'll do two levels of development. I'll do like high-end development, you know, where we're going for the maximum GDV, you know, super high spec. I generally don't want to sell, you know, so I'll always build in a suitable size margin that I could refinance at the end and keep it, whether that be on a buy-to-let model. And, you know, I use developments to kind of facilitate my other investing. So if I develop a block of 12 apartments and I want to keep them at the end, all I'm doing is I'm still a buy-to-let landlord. I've just used development to give me 12 instead of one. You know, so that I've used developments to facilitate my buy-to-let investment. But I'll also then take it to the other. You're nodding as if to think, interesting. Did I explain that well enough?
No, you explained it well enough. I'm just thinking myself for the benefit of people listening. Yeah. I'm nodding away because I'm thinking this all makes perfect sense to me. I'm just nodding away very happily thinking and this is great.
So, you know, we'll roll back on the benefit of that. Let's say I wanted to buy 12 flats to do it. So my goal this year is 12 buy-to-let investments, right? If I buy 12 buy-to-let investments, I'm paying 12 times stamp duty. I'm paying, you know, 12 times 25% deposits, or if I'm going to, you know, I'm doing it 12 times broker's fees, 12, et cetera, et cetera. Well, my development, firstly, I'll probably get stamp duty significantly written off, you know, through multi-homes relief there. I'll be able to get capital allowances on the building. I'll then be developing new properties within that building, of which I'll remortgage at the end. So I've paid stamp duty once, which probably isn't even at full rate anyway because I've had a significant portion of it written off. I'll be able to claim my VAT back with the company structures done correctly, the VAT back obviously on the build of the property. And then on completion, I'll be able to hold those properties. I don't have to sell them to myself. I can move them to another company, which again alleviates stamp duty. So I'm not paying stamp duty. So all of a sudden, if you structure it correctly, I've now got 12 properties in my buy-to-let portfolio from one purchase at the front end, the development, and I've significantly saved on stamp duty, VAT, etc. And I've got capital allowances as a plus, etc. A lot of that is education. A lot of that is, you know, knowing how to do it, knowing. So it's not necessarily for the faint-hearted or the person coming in. But I think people need to look at developments in a different way. A lot of people say, so what strategy do you do in the property world? I'm a developer. I'm a commercial to resi developer. Well, no, I'm a buy-to-let investor. I'm just using commercial developments to facilitate my buy-to-lets. At the end of the day, I'm going to walk out of this deal with 12 buy-to-lets. End of story. Yeah, that's how I view it. So what I was saying about the social side, I now also will approach and I'll almost develop to order for the social sector. So I might say, what are you short of for this social? What will you take off me as a five-year lease? And the answer might be, we're short of one and two bed apartments. So I will then develop specifically a unit of one and two bed apartments, which I know will then go on a five-year lease to that council. So it's kind of developing to order. That's the bigger picture. And I want to roll that nationally rather than very locally. I see there's a national need and a national, now I've identified the relevant and correct funds to tap into. It's a bigger team than me to do that nationally, but actually I see the model that can be rolled out nationally.
People listening in, I mean, people might be screaming, going, well, actually, that's all well and good, Rich, but what about planning? Surely planning, you know, that's going to be a pain in the ass. Doesn't always have to be if you're working with the right people and getting your message across in the way that's going to benefit the very people that approve it. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And that's it. And again, when we go back down the, you know, I'm talking how, you know, for the people listening, going and getting into property and things like that, you know, buy-to-let investment. And that's why I keep harping back onto the buy-to-let, because the staple of my investments is buy-to-let. I still love a good buy-to-let. It's just, I've seen a bigger way to do it. Now with developments, you know, development is something you need specific education in. The money in a development is made at that front end. You could lose more money by missing certain steps in that front end than you could ever make as a profit. So it is about education, working with the right people and understanding the systems. But again, once you're aware of that, once you've learned it, it's almost a process that you just rinse and repeat. When it comes down to planning, you know, I would generally look for, you know, a classic permitted development site. Makes the I'm not into the new build, something that I have never done. New build, building out the ground, it's something I would like to do moving forward. But actually the risk on a permitted development site, you know, you bought it conditionally on the permitted development being passed, you bought it conditionally on certain other things, the risk is far, far less.
In terms of property journey, and I use that term very loosely, so, you know, to me it sounds like you've started off, I'm going to say start off at the bottom, because that's not the right way of putting it, but you started off with stage one, you've then moved nice and slowly up the ladder to now being, you know, a developer working with social housing. Property takes time, and would you say that you have evolved your strategy to do more complex things over time as a result of time learning, and therefore do you think that, you know, your goals have changed over time? You've got used to doing something, nail it, move on to the next thing, but just make it bigger and better each time.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you come back, when you analyse that question, you're looking at time, you know, so yes, it's taken me a long time. You know, don't get me wrong, there's some people in the property space now who've done a lot very far, far quicker and have probably far exceeded where I am in a far shorter period of time. Now, I was always doing this alongside of a career, so it was a limited amount of time. But with that time it's taken me, I think it's allowed me to build up a knowledge base where I'm not just when I learn something, I'm not just skimming the top. I'm actually learning, skimming the top, and I'm actually getting the depth of knowledge as well. So I've got the depth of knowledge and the depth of experience. I think time was important in that. I think what it's done is it's allowed the connections I've built up. So now deals will come out the woodwork where in the past I would see people have deals come out the woodwork and think, how the hell have they just managed to pull that one off? Where did that come from for them? And that's just the classic networking, that classic, and that's what time has allowed me, you know, rather than getting into property and doing every networking event, doing forum months every month, etc., I've kind of steadily done them over a number of years and just consistently done them, consistently met different people. I'll network in different areas, I'll network in different regions, you know. And I mentioned to you before this, you know, so this week I've just done, you know, I don't invest in Liverpool, but we've just tied up 4 lease options in Liverpool, which I'm going to keep for myself. And why? Because actually when I tied them up, they were such good deals that initially in the past, I would have probably handed them on to somebody else, maybe sourced them on, maybe sold them on. But actually, they are such good deals. They were brought to me, Richard, we've got this distressed landlord. Can we do anything? What would you do? How can you help him? Please help me. So somebody reached out to me to seek my kind of help and advice. The individual didn't want the deals, they're not a property investor, but they saw that there was a need to help this landlord. And lo and behold, we managed to help them. We've structured a lease option deal and we've secured that this week. So that type of thing, people have, through networking, you know, I live on the east coast of the UK, they live on the west coast of Liverpool, they've reached out to me, I've been able to facilitate that. And it's just that networking, it's being honest, open. You know, I trust, maybe a lot of people say I trust too much. You know, I've never been stabbed in the back from it, shall we say, where I know a lot of people will be trustworthy until they're stabbed in the back and then walk away. But a lot of my business relationships are built on trust. But networking, what's that time given me? It's given me just more ability to network.
And the word that you said there that I think resonates certainly with myself quite a lot is consistency. Hmm. You know, John Lee Dumas said that on the podcast a couple of months ago. Consistency, consistency, consistency. And if you can do that, whether it's social media posting or networking, you know, start off with doing a few a month, then even if you're then doing, you know, one a month, but you're turning up every month, you're showing your face, and that really helps in the long run.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, you know, there's 1,001 kind of analogies out there that say that, but old Bruce Lee said, you know, you don't want to be fighting against the man who knows 10,000, you know, the man who knows 10,000 kicks, the one you want to be scared of is the one who knows one kick but practiced it 10,000 times. And that's it. It is that consistency. And it's a lot of it as well, which I'm finding again with modern network events, is people are almost trying to power network, speed network, because they're thinking, I need to be there in 12 months' time. So I need to, everyone talks about network. So I've got to network hard. I've got to 10x my networking, as old Grant Cardone would say. And what it's doing is it's, I feel networking for me is 90% listening, 10% talking. You know, I know people listening to this podcast will probably think I'm 90% talk, and you know, because I talk a lot, but it's the ability to listen and ask educated questions is good networking, quality networking, over running into an event. Here's my business card. How can I help you? You know, don't always walk out of a networking event either. Just network. Just be yourself. Don't overthink it. Be yourself and don't try and get too much out of it, shall we say. A lot of people are trying to get too much out of every single event and then self-critiquing themselves. Mindset comes back to.
Well, then half of them don't follow up.
Well, yeah.
So I've always been told, I don't know who told this to me, I've always been told the fortune's in the follow-up. Mm. Always follow up at a networking event. Another thing that I always say is, in terms of when you're like building rapport, having conversations, is the power's in the questions.
Oh, 100%.
So if you ask better questions, clearly structured questions, you'll probably get the answers that you want. You know what? Well, you might not want to hear them, but you'll get the answers that are necessary for it to move on.
It's about knowing, and that comes from experience. Where does experience come from? Networking? From networking. Do you know? But again, what I see a lot of people, and I've seen it many, many times, kind of social media posts and things like that, when people talk about networking, is, you know, go in with a business card and they, you know, if you can't think of a question to ask, ask, how can I help you? Or what is it that you do? Or that can, and I personally don't like that approach, because it's, again, a lot of people seem to be doing it. Networking is about, I have no idea who the person opposite I'm talking to. It's like, hi, I'm Richard, how are you doing? What brought you here tonight? It's conversation. The conversation element in society has disappeared because everyone's on bloody social media. You know, and that's it. You know, so people have lost the ability to socialize. Yeah,
very poignant, very true. I'm in agreement with that. And we've got to, communication in life is very important, especially in property. If you can listen effectively, you've got given one mouth and two ears for a very good reason. So listen effectively, ask well-structured and educational questions, yeah. and you'll probably get exactly what you're after in the first place.
Absolutely, but it may not come that night. Consistency, go back to that same network event, meet the same people, follow up. If somebody strikes an interest in you, whether they be 10 times more experienced than you, or whether they be, you know, you might be 10, you know, for, I might walk into a networking event and, you know, for instance, there's a young chap at the moment who I'm meeting up with next week to take him through kind of some deal analysis. He's simply reached out to me. We've met at a networking event. We've met a couple of times, got on. Then he followed up, classic bit of following. Richard, do you want to meet for a coffee? I'm really struggling with this. Fantastic. We're meeting. I'll always give somebody their time if it's, you know, if I can. But again, he followed up. We networked. There was no forced networking. We just chatted. We got on. We were both in the same event. We commented afterwards, yeah, good event. Let's stay in touch. He followed it up. Fantastic. And now hopefully I'll be able to help him out next week.
I'm talking of following up. I'll bring this to a wrap as well. Yeah. If people do want to follow up from this conversation and get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, I think by all means, you know, if you want to reach out to me, I will genuinely try and help anybody I can, you know, and I think we'll come back to, you know, social media is definitely the best way to do that. So Facebook, I'm just Rich Little on there, or on Instagram, I'm at rich.little. They're the easiest ways. By all means, add me as a friend, send me a message on there, and, you know, let's see if we can meet up. I live in the Yorkshire region. I'm regularly in the Newcastle region. I'm just about to run a development there in North Shields, and also regularly in London, and maybe a few places in between in the near future. So I'm up and down the country. By all means, reach out to me on social media if you've got a question, whatever it may be, ask me anything. Maybe not, why do you never see baby pigeons? Question I once got asked and didn't know the answer. But
that is a very good question.
Yeah. I once said to somebody, any questions, and they threw that one at me. I was like, genuinely don't know the answer to that. There we are.
Ooh.
So yeah, by all means, reach out to me on social media. I'll happily give anybody the time of day I can and help them where I can.
Well, wonderful. Well, you've got me thinking about baby pigeons now, which is quite exciting. And as usual, we'll put links in the show notes to your social media profiles. Fantastic. As well. And yeah, just on that note, again, from yourself, Rich, from myself as well, just, you know, anyone that has made the ultimate sacrifice for their country on such a poignant day, just want to extend our gratitude to yourselves as well.
Fantastic, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, thanks for the interview, and hope your listeners enjoy it.
I'm sure they will.